years, especially considering pharmaceutical companies are some of the most profitable companies in America. When you go to buy a prescription at a pharmacy, you're not only paying what the manufacturer sells the drug for, but also any markup the pharmacy adds on top of that. ScriptCo is changing that. Instead of marking up the price of prescriptions to make a profit, ScriptCo is going the way of Netflix and offering a yearly membership. Co-founder of ScriptCo, Zach Zeller, tells NBC's Today Show,
"The hardest thing in healthcare is no one pays the same price for the same thing. You could have 10 people walk into a pharmacy and get the exact same medication and pay 10 different prices."
And as far as how ScriptCo makes money?
So our money and our revenue comes solely from the membership.
ScriptCo costs $140 a year or $50 for 3 months. From the USA Radio News Phoenix Bureau, I'm Tim Berg. President Biden's choice to lead NASA says it's still possible to land astronauts on the moon by 2024. Bill Nelson making those comments during his Senate confirmation hearing. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
And good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jim Gannot, and this program is called Taking Care of Business. And for the next hour, we're going to talk about issues affecting businesses large and small here in the borough of Flemington in beautiful Hunterdon County, New Jersey, and on the national scene as well. I'll also have my reflections on my time working for and with Steve Califer, who passed away yesterday. It's Thursday, April 22nd, 2021, and I'll have all that and more right now on Taking Care of Business.
And I've been taking care of business every day, taking care of business.
Welcome to the program, everybody. My name is Jim Gannot. Again, the program is called Taking Care of Business. Glad we can get together every Thursday at this time for another episode of Taking Care of Business. Hopefully the program is helping you. I've been getting a lot of emails, texts, some private messages on Facebook. I had a phone call the other day from a gentleman saying, "Where's the archive? I can't find old shows." He was in a panic mode, and I was like, "I'll find it, and we'll get back to you." But he can't listen now because he's at work, so he likes to listen to the show on the archive section. So we are working on that and getting that back up and running for you, and hopefully we'll have that answer for you real soon. Again, this is the only Chamber of Commerce that I know of in the country that has its own radio station. If you're interested in hosting a program, by all means give Chris Phelan a call at the Chamber, 908-782-7115. So that they can talk to you about what the commitment is and whether or not you'd be suitable for a program. If you're watching right now, you're on Facebook, we appreciate it. Don't forget to like our show page, Taking Care of Business with Jim Gannot. And or you could be streaming this live on WHCRDB on a digital player or on HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Again, glad you could join me today. Give you an update. Book sales are going great on The Player. This is the fictional novel I wrote probably about a couple years ago, but finally put it to bed and got it published this year, so very happy with that. That's available for $12.95 at Amazon.com and doing very well with the book sales. Had a couple of interviews with newspapers and radio stations on that, so it's doing very well. And we're now auditioning people to do the voiceovers for an audiobook for this, and it's it's exceeded my expectations. I'm very happy with it. The people who are reviewing it on Amazon are saying some very nice things, so I appreciate that. And then there's other people that say, "Hey, I'm not on Amazon, but I just wanted to let you know I did enjoy the story." So you can buy the book at Amazon.com for $12.95 on the paperback version, I didn't know that this was that big of a thing, but a lot of people are saying, "Hey, I want a signed copy. How do I get that?" If you go to my website, www.jimgannot.com, find the book, find the shop page, order it, and I will sign a copy for you. I'm not sure what my autograph or signature is worth, but hopefully if it's something that means a lot to you, getting a signed copy, I'd be glad to do that for you. Very sad news yesterday here in Flemington, here in Hunterdon County, in the state of New Jersey, actually. I learned yesterday, I got a phone call early in the morning that Steve Califer, who is the owner of Flemington Car and Truck Country, the owner of the Somerset Patriots, had passed away after a long battle with cancer. He was 71 years old. He's one of the state's most widely known business leaders, having built a successful group of auto dealerships and a winning professional sports team. And again, he died yesterday at the age of 71. He's the founder of Flemington Car and Truck Country, the Somerset Patriots minor league baseball team, and also he was an Oscar-nominated movie producer, documentary film producer, and very widely respected philanthropist. We are completely heartbroken by Steve's passing, Patriots president and general manager Patrick McVerry said in a statement. Everyone who ever came into contact with him over the years knows just how special a person he was. He built his dealerships and this team from the ground up with the customers, employees, his family, and the community served always as his top priorities. He taught us all the value of doing things the right way, of taking the time to build long-lasting relationships and making a difference wherever you can. To say that he will be missed is an understatement. Everything we have here is because of his tireless efforts. We are fortunate to have such a wonderful chairman, father figure, and friend. We know his sons Jonathan and Josh will help continue his legacy, and our staff will strive to make him proud every day because we know he will always be with us, guiding our path and showing us ways to succeed. That comment from Patrick McVerry, the president and general manager of the Somerset Patriots. Califer started in the car business in 1973, eventually presiding over a sprawling group that sold 16 different brands from every major manufacturer. He brought baseball to Somerset County in 1999 with the founding of the Somerset Patriots, which last year was named as the AA level affiliate of the New York Yankees, a team that Steve Califer loved. In a December interview with New Jersey Business Magazine, Califer spoke excitedly about what the association with the Yankees would mean for the central New Jersey economy. "We are the hallmark of Somerset County," he said. "We are the epicenter of Bridgewater. This is going to mean business, and not just for the Patriots, but it's going to mean business for restaurants and retail stores post-COVID. It's going to create jobs, and it's really going to become something very special to our community in Somerset County, and I'm very proud of that." Califer hired former Yankees great Sparky Lyle as the Patriots' first manager. Lyle led the team for 14 years and won 5 league championships. "There is no one like Steve Califer," Lyle said in a statement. "From the first day I met him, I loved him. He treated everyone like family and made you feel like the most important person in the world." Among many other honors, Califer was inducted into the New Jersey Hall of Fame in 2020, and he was a member of the New Jersey Business and Industry Association's Board of Trustees for more than 20 years. Steve was many things to many people across the state and beyond. He embodied the true spirit of entrepreneurship through his many impactful endeavors that boosted New Jersey's economy, all while dedicating himself to corporate stewardship and philanthropy with incomparable enthusiasm, said NJBIA President and CEO Michelle Sikirka in a statement. Califer's philanthropic activities included fundraising efforts for Somerset Medical Center's Foundation, for which he served as Chairman Emeritus, and the RWJ Barnabas Health, for which he served on the Board of Trustees. Califer is survived by his wife Suzanne, 2 sons, and 5 grandchildren. The Patriots said services will be private and that the team will honor his memory at its TD Bank ballpark later this year. I had the distinct pleasure of working for Steve as a member of the Somerset Patriots staff when we first opened down in Bridgewater. I was one of the PA announcers there, and my job was multifunctional. I was a PA announcer. I was the on-field host. That was the mascot. I was cameraman, sound man. We all pitched in and did whatever we could. And the comment by Patrick McVerry is very true. The bar was set very high from opening night, and it wasn't told to us. It was just what you came to expect from working from Steve. He had that certain level. He wasn't going to let us slough off. And even though you play a 72-game home game series, he wasn't going to let us take any nights off from doing a good job. And you always wanted to please him no matter what we did. We had a lot of promotions that – and he never, I never saw him yell at anybody. I never saw him, but, you know, he would tell you what you were doing right, what you were doing wrong, and how to fix it. And he always had a very calming effect on you. And even if you screwed up, he'd be like, let's learn from this and move on. The one story, and as we found out that he had passed yesterday, a lot of people started texting me because they knew that I was close to him. And and respected him so much. And so a lot of people started texting me, calling me, emailing me and saying, hey, did you see this? And I said, yes. And they said, by last night at around 8 o'clock, I got probably 20 or 30 requests saying, are you going to talk about him on your show tomorrow? And I said, yeah, I'm definitely going to mention it. And they said, well, you have to tell the story of the diamond dig. This is a story that Steve and I shared that every time we saw each other, this story would come up in our conversation. And he, if we were with a group of people, he would introduce me and say, this man saved my life, and let me explain how, and then he would tell the story. So the story of the diamond dig goes like this. We were having a promotion. I think it was in our, it was definitely our first year. Maybe we were open for about 2 weeks, maybe even less. And Sherman and Son Jewelers, Ron Sherman, had created this promotion with the Patriots called a diamond dig. It's very popular in minor league baseball, where a jewelry store will provide a diamond in like a plastic baggie. The team will bury it somewhere in the infield, and then when you rake over the infield, you really can't tell where the dirt was disturbed. And then you would invite the ladies in attendance that night, who I think had to be 18 and over, to come on the field after the game. You'd give each of them a metal spoon, invite them into the area, the turf area, not the grass area, of the infield, and they would start digging until one of them found the plastic baggie with the diamond in it. And we started this promotion, and we probably had about 400 women that were going to dig for the diamond. I had Mr. Califer on the field. I had Ron Sherman and his family on the field with me. And, you know, we counted it down and said, okay, dig. And they all these ladies ran out between first and third base, and they're digging furiously. And our groundskeeper at the time, Ray Cipriani, I'll never forget his look, because the infield looked like a meerkat had just gone, a meerkat family had just gone crazy. There was dirt everywhere, little mounds. It was probably going to take him all night to get that field back into playing shape for the next day. Well, we thought this promotion was going to be over in 20, 30 seconds, and it just kept going and going. And, you know, 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, still no diamond. Now women are coming up to us, and I'm standing with, you know, Steve Califer, I'm standing with Ron Sherman, and women are angry, and their hands are bleeding because they have blisters from digging, you know, with these spoons in the dirt, and nobody can find this diamond. And I asked Ray Cipriani, do you know where it was buried? And I pull him aside. He says, yeah, it's somewhere between first and second base. He goes, I buried it. It's like 4 or 5 inches down. I was like, okay. He goes, I have the coordinates between first and second base. He goes, I measured them. He goes, oh, that's a problem. I go, why is that a problem? He says, well, I had to fire a guy today. And when he left, he slashed all 4 tires on my truck. It's at the shop getting new tires put on it. I was like, great. So we don't know where the diamond is. We can say it should be here, but we didn't know. So we told the ladies, if you're between second and third base, switch over to first and second base. They're digging furiously. Again, more women coming up to us with blisters on their hands, bleeding blisters on their hands. They've been on their hands and knees. Their shoes are muddy. Their knees and their pants are all dirty, and they are getting pissed. So at this point, we kind of call the timeout, and I would say probably 20 minutes have already elapsed. We call a timeout. Nobody's come up with this diamond, and now I have 400 angry women walking towards me and Mr. Califer and Ron Sherman, and they're screaming at us. You talk about one woman being angry. Try having 400 women being angry at you all at the same time. So I actually told Ron Sherman, take your wife, take your kids, and go back up into your luxury suite, because I really don't want you down here right now. So he takes his family and leaves the suite. And Ron had always said that, you know, he goes, I think you saved my life that night too. But Mr. Califer stayed with me, and he was right next to me. And I said, no matter what you do, you always stay behind me. Don't be in front of me. And so now we're trying to figure out, what are we going to do? We have all these angry women. So he whispers in my ear, and he said, tell everybody we're going to give them, we're going to print out 2 tickets to an upcoming baseball game, and they can come for free. So we made that announcement. And not that we thought that was going to be the end all, but we thought at least it would be a good faith gesture. We have the people in the ticket office printing tickets to hand to all the ladies at the game. I have Mr. Califer in my ear giving me instructions. I have executives from the Patriots in my headset telling me, you know, what we're trying to do. Hey, we need 10 more minutes to print all these tickets. We need this. It was a disaster. That's why we call it the Diamond Dig disaster. So we keep going, and these women are screaming at us. And finally, Mr. Califer pulls me aside. I get about 10 feet away from the ladies, and he goes, all right, here's what we're going to do. He goes, tell them that we're going to print a new set of tickets, give everybody one, and we'll pick one out of a hat, and that person will win the diamond. So we brought it back to the 400 angry women, and we said, this is what we're going to do. And they were like, okay, we're okay with that. We wait 10 minutes for the ticket office to print tickets. We give everybody a ticket. We take their stub. We put it in there. Just as we pull the new number, a woman standing maybe 5 feet away from me yells, I found it. And we're like, you found what? She goes, on her shoe was a little plastic baggie. And when she picked it up, she found the diamond. So now we have a problem. We've already pulled a winner from the ticket, and we now have her with the diamond in her hand. And again, Mr. Califer hops in my ear, and he says, they both win. We're going to make it so that I will buy the diamond for the new lady, and the first winner is still a winner. And then they would have to go get it set in a ring or something like that. But every time that he saw me after that, either at the ballpark, in meetings, when he would visit me in my store, he would always, you know, point his finger. He says, and he'd have that glint in his eye. He goes, you saved my life. That those women were ready to kill me that night. And I go, I don't know what they were going to do with spoons. It would have been probably a very painful death. But I will never forget how every time he introduced me, and you know, we would be at similar meetings, and he would always he'd say, come here, Jim. You got to meet this person, that person, and then he would. He would relay this story of the diamond dig, and it got to a point where it's kind of growing in the story. But it was always something common that we shared that, you know, every time we got together, we would laugh about it and talk about it. And years later, when I opened my business, probably a week or two after I opened, he walked in and, He said to me, and this kind of goes back to Pat's comments as well. He said, I am so proud of you. He goes, I love it when my guys do something with themselves, with their lives. And I already had a successful career, but he was so happy that I had opened my own business. And, you know, he took a tour of the place, and I showed him what we do and everything like that. And he said, I'm gonna get as much business to you as I possibly can. You know, so if it was Employee of the Month or something like that, we would do that engraving for him. We'd done some special promotional items for him. But he was always stopping in. He would eat breakfast at the Flemington Coffee Shop, walk three doors down to my place, knock on the window, and then we would sit and chat for about a half an hour before he went over to the dealerships. And I could ask him anything about business. And, you know, he would answer it. Like, how would you handle this situation? How would you handle that? And so he served as a mentor. Even though he didn't know the trophy industry, he knew business and he knew people. And he would always, you know, give me great advice along that path. And I said yesterday in a Facebook post, the success that I've achieved in the trophy industry and in this business, and even in surviving through COVID, is in large part in direct relation to the conversations that I had with Steve Califer. He took a genuine interest in me. He would tell me how to deal with people. He would tell me how to deal with difficult customers. You know, he was a big believer in the customer is always right. And if they're not right, at least make them feel like they're right. And he just always put the customer first, which I liked. And he says, you know, make your customer happy and you'll be happy. So that was good. Another gentleman who was always very influential in my business life was Robert Vaughn, who owned Vaughn's Deli in Somerville. Sixth grade education, one of the smartest businessmen I ever met in my entire life. So between the two of them, they were my two mentors who have shaped me in my business life. And as I'm writing my new book, The Action Plan, which is a business book designed both for owners of businesses and employees in those businesses and management teams in those businesses. A lot of what I'm going to be imparting in that book is based on conversations I had with Mr. Califer or real world practices that I would see with him. And I'll never forget, you know, he always, regardless of what our common bond was, whether it was the Diamond Dig or the Patriots or talking about business, our conversations always ended the same way. He would always say, "How's your health? How you doing? Are you getting enough sleep? Are you taking care of yourself? Are you eating right?" He always showed that genuine concern for me as a person. And, you know, when you what a lot of people will think of him and remember about him is his wealth. His wealth didn't compare to the size of his heart and his genuine caring for the people around him. And if you worked for him, whether it was at his dealerships or whether it was for the Patriots or anywhere else, he cared about everybody. And I got to work with him on some special projects that just he and I worked on. And we would talk and we'd be kind of trying to formulate a plan, and I would make a suggestion. And if I got it right, boy, his eyes would just light up with this little glint and you'd see this little sparkle. And he's like, that's what's going to make this successful. And I used to always, you know, love having those conversations with him. So definitely somebody who's going to be missed in this area. His philanthropy, his caring of people, I don't think will ever be matched. I've seen a lot of stories where family members have written and said, "Hey, when I had cancer, Steve called me. When I had this, Steve called me. When my mother was going through something, you know, Steve would reach out to us." That's the kind of person. And he didn't do it for the accolades or anything like that. He just did it because he genuinely cared for his employees and for his customers. And I think that's something that is genuinely going to be missed in this area. You can't enter this state without seeing a billboard for Flemington Car and Truck Country. And in addition to, you know, Flemington Furs, I think Flemington Car and Truck Country is what put this area on the map. And he will definitely be missed, you know, by me and by his many customers and by his many employees that have had the honor of working for him over the years. And I love the stories that people are sharing with me about him and their experiences with him. And hopefully the Diamond Dig story put a smile on your face as well. And, you know, I'll never forget him, you know, telling some very important people that we met along the way, whether they were sports celebrities or movie stars or anything else. When he introduced me, he'd always say, "This is the man who saved my life." And, you know, I don't know if death by spoon is an option, but that's how he saw it. And he will be sadly missed in this area for sure. And with that, I'm going to close out this segment of the program, and we're going to jump to the news. And when we come back, I have a story on our national debt and what the true value of it is and what we need to do about it. You're listening to Taking Care of Business right here on HuntingtonChamberRadio.com.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
The House, in a party-line vote on Thursday, approved legislation to make Washington, D.C. the 51st state in the nation, sending the bill to the Senate. Winning a vote in the Senate will likely require ending the filibuster that requires most legislation to clear a 60-vote hurdle. Even then, not all 50 Democrats in the Senate back making D.C. a state. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy says he hasn't heard from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi regarding forming a commission to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
"I have gotten nothing from her. Leader McConnell has received nothing from her. She was even in my office yesterday. She could have dropped the letter off. Nothing from her. So I'm not quite sure who she's talking to or what she's talking about."
The California Republican also saying he will not negotiate over a formation of a committee in the media. This is USA Radio News.
Now is a great time to replace your worn-out windows during the Renewal by Anderson 25-year savings event. Upgrade your home today. Buy 4 windows and get the 5th one free. Plus, get 12 months with no interest, no money down, and no payments. Call now. Get 4 windows and get the 5th one free. Installation and warranty included. Renewal by Anderson takes every CDC-recommended safety precaution to protect your family. For 25 years, people have trusted us for their window replacement needs, and you can too. Call now to learn about our Buy 4, Get the 5th one free window replacement offer.
800-603-8489. 800-603-8489. 800-603-8489. That's 800-603-8489.
Interest accrues from date of purchase, but is waived if paid in full within 12 months. Other conditions apply. We've adjusted our operations to serve you safely following all CDC guidelines. Visit renewalbyanderson.com for details.
And I've been taking care of business every day. Taking care of business every way. I've been taking care of business. It's all right. Taking care of business and working overtime.
You're listening to Taking Care of Business right here on HuntertonChamberRadio.com, WHCRDB, and live on our Facebook stream. So glad you could join me. As, again, earlier in the program, we talked about the passing of Steve Califer. Wanted to talk to you. A lot of people have been asking me, you know, do you think it's right that the government is just printing money? You know, $2 trillion here, $4 trillion there, things like that. And the answer is no, and I've never been a big fan of when bills are passed and it's just loaded with what they call pork and you know, home state projects and things like that. So I did a little digging around, and there's a board in New York City, a digital board that shows the national debt that is currently, I think, showing something like $26 trillion or $28 trillion. The actual number is actually $123 trillion, and I'll get to that in a minute. But if you were to try to pay that down, it would cost every taxpayer $800,000. Now, years and years ago, I'll never forget having a conversation with my father, and this may go back 30 or 40 years when the debt was in the billions, not trillions. And there was a story on the news, and they said if every American paid, and it was like $1,000, I said, Dad, why don't we just build American people $1,000 and get back to zero balance. And it never obviously happened. So now we have an even larger debt. And then the stories you hear out of Washington, D.C. is free education, free this, free that. You know, it has to be paid somehow. When you hear we're going to print $4.1 trillion and it's going to be whether it's for COVID relief or something like that, the debt keeps rising. So America's national debt now exceeds $123 trillion, according to a new report, or more than four times the official figure of $28 trillion, as calculated by the United States Treasury Department at the end of March. Federal spending related to the CCP virus pandemic and economic lockdown added nearly $10 trillion to the total in 2020, according to the latest edition of the Financial State of the Union 2021 report, which was compiled and published annually by Chicago-based nonprofit Truth in Accounting, or the TIA. But spending amid the pandemic represents only a small portion of the total difference between the official government figure and TIA's calculation. Our measure of the government's financial condition includes reported federal assets and liabilities, as well as promised but not funded Social Security and Medicare benefits, the report states. So what that means is, we've promised people that they will still receive their Social Security for generations. We've promised people that there will always be Medicare benefits. So their number is inflated because as people age up, as I'm going to do, I'll be 60 next month. You know, as we start getting into the point where we're qualifying for Medicare, we start taking Social Security, that still has to be funded. So elected and non-elected officials have made repeated financial decisions that have left the federal government with a debt burden of $123.11 trillion, including unfunded Social Security and Medicare. The TIA report includes in its total debt calculation $55.12 trillion in unfunded Medicare benefits and $41.20 trillion in unfunded Social Security benefits. Treasury officials don't include unfunded benefits because they claim recipients have no right to future payments, only to those under current entitlement laws. The total debt, according to the report, equates to a $796,000 burden for every federal taxpayer because the federal government would need such a vast amount of money from taxpayers to cover this debt. It received an F grade for its financial condition. Congratulations, America. You got an F for your financial condition. Now, unlike many state governments, the federal government doesn't maintain a cash reserve to deal with spending necessitated by unexpected crises such as a virus pandemic. The coronavirus pandemic and related stimulus packages have caused some of the deterioration because the government had to borrow money to weather the pandemic. If the federal government was properly prepared for a crisis with a true rainy day fund, it would not have had to borrow any money, TIA stated. Defense and veterans benefits accounted for the largest share of federal spending in 2020 at 23%, followed by health and human services with 19%, Social Security with 16%, and interest on the debt at 5% and 2% on education. Fully a third, or 35% of the spending, went to what TIA described as other. Some of the responses, spokesman for Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, and Senator Lindsey Graham, respectively, the chairman and ranking minority member of the Senate Budget Committee, didn't respond to requests for comment. Similarly, a spokesperson for the House Budget Committee Chairman, Representative John Yarmuth, a Democrat out of Kentucky, also did not respond. Mondays are typically travel days for senators returning from their states and representatives from the districts. The spokesman for Representative Jason Smith, a Republican out of Missouri, said the budget's panel ranking minority member referred to a March 31st statement in which Smith criticized new spending proposals from President Joe Biden and congressional Democrats. Washington Democrats are embracing an historically disturbing appetite for spending. They just passed a nearly $2 trillion bailout bill. President Biden is now proposing they turn right back around and cut a check for another $2 trillion to spend on a massive grab bag of policies all tied together with talking points. All the while, the president reportedly has yet another $2 trillion spending proposal in the back pocket, awaiting its own news cycle. So, a lot of consultants will agree with this. Campaign strategists and nonprofit activists interviewed by Epoch Times told the TIA report expressed agreement that debt requires serious attention to get it under control. Jim Manley, who's the former communications director to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, said at some point both parties are going to have a serious negotiation regarding the need to get our fiscal house in better order. And that includes both taxes and spending, but I don't see that happening anytime soon because our politics are just too toxic. But Manley said, in the meantime, interest rates are low and the economy is digging itself out of the hole that the pandemic caused, but there is no reason for Democrats to be at all concerned about the Republicans' newfound focus on cutting spending after everything the last administration did. He was referring, he said, to the 2017 tax reform legislation enacted by Republican majorities in the House and Senate and signed into law by President Donald Trump. Another Democratic campaign strategist, Kevin Chavous, told the Epoch Times, "This has been an issue that both parties have simply failed to address. It will not be fixed, though, by doing the same things over and over." Chavous said he expects that the infrastructure bill will create jobs and grow the economy by investing in modern technology and cleaner energy sources. Things like a nationalized electric grid and expanded broadband access will make Americans more productive and more competitive in years to come. It is an expense we have to make sooner rather than later. Taxpayers Protection Alliance President David Williams pointed to the need to cut federal spending. A debt of $123 trillion should be a wake-up call for the country. The bill is coming due very soon, which could have dire consequences for taxpayers and the country. Williams said Biden and congressional leaders are seemingly oblivious to the stark fiscal crisis happening right under their noses, and worse yet, if they are aware of the deep financial issues, they are clearly not doing anything to fix the problem. Instead of finding ways to spend more money, Congress and the president need to find ways to cut spending. Citizens Against Government Waste President Tom Schatz noted that President Thomas Jefferson said the nation's representatives shouldn't accumulate debts that can't be paid in their own time. And while this has been problematic for years, it has never been this significant. Schatz said he believes members of Congress have an obligation to attempt to bring spending under control and ensure that present and future taxpayers are not forced to fund any federal program that is duplicative, wasteful, and inefficient. When asked TIA President Sheila Weinberg if it's reasonable to depend upon future economic growth to solve the debt problem, she said no and noted that the Treasury Department agrees. The authors of the financial report of the U.S. government have deemed that under current law and policy, a massive implied increase in the ratio of reported debt to GDP, future debt will be growing faster than the GDP, is simply unsustainable, she said. In other words, under current law and policy, we can't grow our way out of this, especially considering that Medicare grows faster than inflation. So at some point, our political leaders in Washington, D.C. have got to come together and address this issue. And this is not a anti-Biden statement or an anti-Trump statement. This is an anti-government statement because nobody's done anything about this, probably since Reagan and maybe even before. But it's time that we really take a hard and fast look at what's happening. I had asked my financial planner last year, I had a meeting with him, and I said, how does this work? If we're going to borrow $2 trillion, you know, doesn't it screw up the value of the dollar if we keep borrowing from it? And he said, no, not really. He goes, if we were borrowing from China or Japan or something like that, another country, and had to pay it back, then yeah, it's massive debt load. He said, with this stuff, we could simply just write it off, you know, cancel the debt and bring that level of debt load down. But there's a lot of debt load that you can't do that with. So especially when they talk about Medicare and Social Security. So it's going to be harder. And until somebody in Washington, D.C. wakes up and says, we've got to stop this spending and get it in line, we're digging ourselves a very, very big hole that I'm not sure we'll ever be able to get out of. The other part in any bill, and this is when I talk about the pork section, if you're going to do a COVID relief bill for the American people, just do a COVID relief bill for the American people. Don't add bridges and tunnels and infrastructure projects and things in your home state in order to garner a vote. Just keep it for the people. I guarantee you a $2 trillion bill didn't have to be $2 trillion to get the money to the American people that needed it the most. Probably could have been done maybe for a quarter of that, if not even less. So couple things to think about there, and I'm not really sure whether we're ever going to, you know, come out of this one. I had an interesting story that kind of pertains to, you know, my industry, and I'm not really sure how to address it from the standpoint of being the producer versus the consumer. But Patagonia, if you know that clothing line, recently came out with a statement that said that they were going to stop allowing their apparel to be decorated. And what we mean by that is like this shirt here. You couldn't put my logo on a piece of Patagonia clothing. And it said it's banning added logos to help the environment. And while its intentions is good, it's missing the point. So helping the environment doesn't typically get under people's skin, but that's been the case with Patagonia, which ruffled quite a few feathers last week with its announcement that it was forbidding the placement of additional logos on its clothing because they want to reduce the lifespan of a garment, often by a lot. So how does it shorten the lifespan? How many of you are wearing apparel that you got from a company you no longer work at, but you wear it because it's comfortable, it keeps you warm, you don't really care, you know? Or maybe you hand it down to your children or something like that. So how does it shorten the lifespan? In the missive on its website, the company states people change jobs and the extra logo makes for an awkward regift. People tend not to pass logo gear down to their kids, and not everyone wants to be an advertisement on the weekends, even if they're proud to go into work on the weekdays. The result? Perfectly good gear ends up forgotten in the closet, or worse, gets tossed in the trash. When we made this decision, we accepted it might cost us some business, the company writes later on in the post, but we hope you'll see this shift for what it is, another of our ongoing efforts to support a healthy planet and a call to action. I don't see it that way. Now, sure, Patagonia's intentions are good, something I would expect from one of the most prominent environmental stewards in the corporate world, but by eliminating branding, Patagonia is perpetuating fallacies about the promotional products industry that contribute to waste and disuse instead of promoting values that make our industry a greater asset to the environmental movement. And from a sales perspective, you know, if I can't decorate Patagonia, well, that means I'm taking it out of the showroom. I can't sell your product. But if Nike comes in, Under Armour comes in, Carhartt comes in, Eddie Bauer comes in and says, sure, slap a logo on all our products, I'm not going to be selling much Patagonia. So I think you'll see sales fall. Now, Patagonia obviously has the right to decide who, if anybody, gets to advertise on its garments. 2 years ago, the company announced it was shifting its corporate apparel strategy to cater to certified B corporations, 1% for the planet members and the other mission-driven companies that prioritize the planet. It's not the only prominent retail brand to be so selective. Under Armour has also been notoriously strict in its co-branding requirements, ditto for the North Face, which reportedly last month turned down an order of 400 jackets from a Texas oil and gas company Apparel brand Patagonia is a prominent voice for environmental activism and initiatives, including its support of 1% for the planet, where companies donate 1% of their profits to environmental causes. So, again, if you take Patagonia at its word, it arrived at the decision by putting the environment first. Yeah, it's likely that for high-quality brands such as theirs, an item with a logo is on average likely to be worn or kept longer than one with a company logo. By the way, I don't believe this is always true. Many blank items are elevated through elegant design, imprinting, and packaging, but it misses the greater point. So, you know, it's a hard argument to have with people. They want to be stewards of the environment, and yet customers want the Patagonia clothing, but now they can't get it because they won't allow it to be logoed. So, to me, it just doesn't make sense. So, what are your thoughts? I mean, would you respect the company more if they don't allow logo? Would you wear their product more? Now, when I go out on weekends with my wife, I'm not wearing a logo jacket. That's always the case. She doesn't want me advertising. You know, she wants to, let's just go out to dinner, and we don't need to be, you know, wearing billboards. I totally get it. I'm not a NASCAR driver. I don't need to have patches all over my chest telling you what products I support or drive for. But in this instance, you know, but on, you know, Monday through Friday, I'm always in Crown Trophy apparel. You know, you'll never see me without, you know, a Crown Trophy shirt on, wearing a Crown Trophy jacket or something like that. So I think in that respect, Patagonia is missing the mark. The part about you leave a company, you don't wear it. I still wear jackets from a company I worked for 10 years ago. That's like saying that I won't hit a golf ball that I got 30 years ago from an insurance company I used to work for. You know, I hit them. You know, so just because it's, you know, it may be a different argument, but it's not saying that I'm not going to enjoy the product long after. So, again, I think Patagonia is missing the mark. Would love to hear your thoughts. Feel free to reach out to me at trophyjim@yahoo.com and let me know if it would affect your buying decision if a company said you couldn't decorate their apparel. Looking at the next story and the clock. Okay, let's go over this one. So, one of the topics that keeps coming up in my email feed from people is, and it's, I think it's both, I'm gonna weigh it equally. When you're working at home, or if you're working in the office, since COVID started, people are finding that they are distracted more. When you're working at home, obviously, if you have children at home and they're being, you know, homeschooled, you're going to have distractions. But they're finding that they're spending more time on their phones, on their devices, looking at things that aren't work-related. And they're asking me, how can I fix this? And this will be an upcoming chapter in my book called The Action Plan. So here's some critical advice to redirect the wasteful time spent on your digital device into workplace productivity. Now, life is definitely not easy in business these days. Your job can sometimes be impossible, first to manufacture without a single flaw, a visual representation of a client's creative vision, and then to install also flawlessly that specific vision onto a affinity of possible services and configurations. Your clients are finicky, demanding, and prone to agonizing last-minute changes of heart. So the demands of today's information and social media often seem to create more challenges than they solve. So don't we all want to get back to simpler days when there was quiet time to think and plan? Can you use modern communication tools productively and still have time to, you know, have a life? The answer is an emphatic yes, but serious discipline is required. So here are 17 different ways that you can start. The first is to time yourself. Now, you have to recognize your dependency on your devices. Once you know how much time you're spending on your phone, it's easier to make changes, i.e. spending entire days or weekends screen-free, but many people underestimate exactly how often and for how long they get distracted. Again, it has to do with evolutionary-inspired urges that make vital pursuits pleasurable. Originally, it was eating and sex, but now that's becoming flicking through Twitter. To get an accounting, simply check your screen time statistics on your iPhone or tap Digital Well-Being under an Android phone settings to see how your use is trending. I didn't know that those even existed, but when you do it, very often you'd be shocked at how much time you're spending on your phone. And that's everything from Facebook to checking the stock market to texting and all that stuff. Screen time. So again, those apps are digital well-being under an Android phone setting or your screen time statistics on an iPhone. I challenge you to, at the end of the day, take a look at that and see how much time you're using. And if you start to see 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hour, you need to curb your enthusiasm for your electronic devices. You can also control the cues. Now, to live with frequent notifications is to outsource decisions about how your attention is deployed to a motley collection of friends, colleagues, and strangers, most of whom have no incentive to put your interests first. So turn off all your alerts, all the buzzing, the banners, the pop-ups, the ringtones, and all that stuff. And the next, identify what triggers you to grab the phone. There was a story on 60 Minutes about how things like Facebook and other programs had actually developed an algorithm that would make you want to pick up your phone every 10 minutes and check. And then when they realize you're on the phone, they might push a notification through that a friend has just posted a new photo. So is it, you want to make sure that you're not as reliant on the device as seems. You want to inventory your apps and usage. Now, take an inventory of your tech use and evaluate each item for its usefulness, working on the assumption that if something can't justify itself from a professional or personal angle, it's out. This is where you're going to look at your home screen and your app screen and figure out which of these you actually use on a regular basis. I do this exercise probably once a month, and if I haven't used an app in months, I just get rid of it. I used to play Sudoku. I haven't played it in a while. I was repeating games. Delete it. Do I need the United Airlines app? I'm not flying anywhere. Nope. Get rid of it. Some news services, if I use them for the show, yeah. Otherwise, they can go. So, again, let's clean out the apps. You don't need as many as you think you do. You also want to start with what we call a one-month detox. Now, Cal Newport, one of the leaders of the digital minimalism school of tech use, recommends a more aggressive approach. Completely unplug for a period of time to give your brain and emotions a breather so that you can reassess your digital needs. In digital minimalism, choosing a focused life in a noisy world, he advocates a month-long digital detox, a period in which a person takes a complete break from all optional technologies. When it's over, the idea is that you slowly reintroduce these technologies back on your own terms. You don't go back to what you did before. You rebuild it from scratch, but with intention. He says the key is to ensure that all the tech you have is amplifying something that you really care about. I don't know of anybody who could put their phone down for a month. How many people, and this really annoys me, like if I go out to dinner with friends and somebody pulls out their phone, like if I'm talking to you and all of a sudden you're on your phone, I'm done talking. You know, you're not paying attention, so I'm not going to, give you the time of day anymore. It's just not worth my effort. Obviously, what I'm talking about doesn't interest you. So, and one of the best Christmases we ever had in my family, we invited everybody over. I had seven nieces and nephews in my house. And I took out a basket, and I said, everybody put your basket or your phone in the basket. And what happened was great, because at first they all hated that thought. I said, you will be rewarded at the end, I guarantee you, but, you know, just put your phones in the basket. So they put their phones in the basket, I put it on top of the refrigerator. And what happened over the course of the next 3 or 4 hours was they talked to one another, they played games with one another, they watched a movie, they engaged with one another. And it was probably the first time in 3 or 4 years that I'd ever seen my nieces and nephews actually talking to each other. At the end of the night, I gave them all their phones back and a $20 bill. They were happy. Now when they come over to my house, they go, are we putting our phones away? Can we get another $20? I'll be glad to do it if it's going to mean that you're going to spend time with your cousins. You want to create friction or sludge. Triumphs of willpower are surprisingly rare in everyday human situations. The central force for eliminating bad habits, such as excessive phone use, according to social psychologist Wendy Wood, is what we call friction. If we can make bad habits more inconvenient, then inertia can carry us the rest of the way. The more hassle, the more success, she says, in good habits, bad habits. Thus, turning the phone off completely is much more effective than silencing it, not because you become any less curious about who might have sent the text, but because powering it up is a drag. Delete apps from your phone. If it's important, you can always check through the browser. You want to keep your phone out of sight. Studies have shown even the presence of a mobile phone on a dinner table is enough to disrupt the greater conversation as the gaze of both parties turns repeatedly to the device. I never bring my phone to the dinner table. If I go out to dinner, it's always, you know, in my jacket pocket, and I won't look at it until I get home that night. I've never heard of anybody tell me that, you know, the most important thing that ever happened in their life was something that they received on a text message. You also want to use ComTech. Now, there's a number of programs that promise to combat electronic distraction. Examples include Freedom, which temporarily cuts internet access, Antisocial, which locks down Facebook and Twitter, Stay Focused, which is an extension for the Chrome browser that turns off Twitter after 45 minutes of daily use, and single task devices like the Kindle ensure your attention doesn't get diluted. Instapaper allows you to read articles later, offline if you want, confident you won't miss out on anything. Ditto is a large button that clips to your belt or blouse and vibrates when you get a text or call from designated people in your address book. Yes, it's a reinvented pager, but it allows you to stash your phone in your bag or out of sight and out of reach, giving you the reassurance you'll be contactable for, say, an emergency involving a VIP customer. Or you can go old tech. They are getting harder to find, but a phone that does nothing but makes calls ensures you won't be led astray by the digital off-ramps of a smartphone. Similarly, get a cheap alarm clock and move your phone charger outside of the bedroom. You want to outsource your social. When you can't trust yourself to not get sucked in or just find the time requirements of social media too onerous, consider outsourcing the task to a media management service or a staff member. You may think no one can share your brand message like you can, but you should really give someone, i.e. a millennial, a chance and watch what happens. Remember that it's usually disappointing. Is there anything more annoying and time-wasting than falling for a clickbait headline? The ancient idea that what we desire isn't necessarily what we enjoyed has received support from modern neuroscience. Dopamine, it turns out, is probably better understood as a desire chemical rather than a feel-good drug. It can be triggered in huge quantities in the near-total absence of pleasure. And this explains why attaining some long-sought-after object or accolade often feels like a letdown from the pursuit. Set if-then rules. In study after study that were peer-reviewed, one teachable skill stands out as crucial for habit change, deciding on if-then rules in advance, says Carrie Patterson, author of Change Anything. And she says, you have to decide what are the crucial moments, such as when you find yourself instinctively reaching for your phone when a less than fun task presents itself. Formulate a rule, being as specific as possible. If I find myself reaching for social media, I'll drop to the floor and do 10 push-ups and spend 5 minutes on the task I dislike. So if-then. And then say om, meditate. Everyone and their dog is doing it. Literally, pet and parent meditation is actually a thing. Your brain needs downtime, silence, a chance to be with your thoughts. Meditation teaches you to focus the mind without outside stimulation, strengthening self-awareness so you retain the capacity to choose, say, when to go online and when to disconnect. Don't have time? Just try 5 minutes a day. You want to prioritize away the overload. As noted on the productivity podcast, precisionchange.com, there is something questionable about the whole information overload complaint. If we couldn't handle vast amounts of information, we'd have a breakdown each time we stepped into wild nature. Think of the cacophony of sound, crawling bugs, moving leaves. The real trouble is in the modern world, we have defined too many things as worthy of having the power to destruct us. So you want to stay aware of what generally deserves your attention. Also, take a digital Sabbath. In digital minimalism's Newport total breaks aren't an option, you could try a digital Sabbath to put some distance between you and social media. As the name suggests, it's once a week. Should involve the whole family and run perhaps from Saturday evening to Sunday night. You want to take proper breaks. Author and workplace consultant Tony Schwartz has argued, we tend to vastly underestimate the importance of restoration in human life. We operate on a multitude of rhythms, from the seasonal to the circadian, to the ultradian, the peaking and dipping of energy every 2 hours or so. Each cycle must alternate between exertion and rest if we are to function well. To concentrate on a task, you need to block out distractions. So take a break. Forget FOMO and embrace JOMO. According to the entrepreneur Katarina Fake, who helped popularize the term FOMO, the fear of missing out, is an age-old problem exacerbated by technology. Thanks to Facebook, we've never been so aware of what others are doing and what we aren't. How to calm your anguish? Try JOMO, the joy of missing out, which is basically the reaffirmation that what you've decided to do, build a business, spend time with your family, matters more. And finally, get into nature. In our world of relentless, aggressive demands on our attention, U.S. academics Rachel and Stephen Kaplan argue that nature does something different. It exerts soft fascination. The result is what the Kaplans called cognitive quiet, in which the muscle of effort, attention, the one you use to concentrate on work, gets to rest, but without the boredom you'd feel if you had nothing to focus on. This helps explain why even just a trip to the local park may seize just enough of your attention to let the rest of your mind relax. I love that last one, the get into nature. And I do it with technology. I have an app on my phone called the Stargazer app, and I'll go out on my back porch at night, look up, and I just want to see, like, what constellation is that? What star is that? Is that a planet? And and then when I identify, I say, well, that's Mars or that's Pluto or something like that, I put the phone away, and then I just, do some stargazing. And to me, that is a heck of a lot more fun than just checking who's doing what on Facebook. So there are 17 tips, critical advice to redirect your wasteful time spent on digital devices and turn it back into workplace productivity. So, hey, Jill, thanks for watching. I appreciate you stopping in. As always, it's been my pleasure joining you today, and I always end the show with some great advice I got from my father when I was just 6 years old that guides me in my personal and professional life every day. Maybe you can use it in your lives as well when he said, never let it rest until your good is better and your better is best. If you have ideas for upcoming programming topics or guests, email me at trophyjim@yahoo.com, or you can connect with me on LinkedIn, on Twitter at JimGaneau83, or on Facebook on the show's page, Taking Care of Business with Jim Ganeau. For more information about me and my businesses, visit www.jimganeau.com. I'm Jim Ganeau, and I'm taking care of business. Make it a productive week, everybody.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
President Biden says governments and businesses need to step up and lead in the global fight against climate change. Biden announcing the U.S. financial plan to tackle climate change.
We are issuing America's first ever international climate finance plan. This plan represents our vision for financing the global climate response in a coordinated way.
Biden hosting a global summit on climate change, also noting the growing costs of extreme weather events around the world. A group of Republican senators is releasing an outline of a $568 billion infrastructure plan, putting out a narrower alternative to the president's $2.3 trillion proposal. Democrats on the Hill already scoffing at the plan, saying it is way too small. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
Police officer down. It's shocking. The number of cops killed in the line of duty jumped almost 100% last year. Defunding police, stripping them of legal protections, woke culture. It's a dangerous time. But Greg Kelly is fighting back. All this week, Greg's on Newsmax TV with his special series, Cops Under Fire. Greg Kelly exposes the real threat to the police and you. Newsmax TV is standing up for our brave men and women. Watch Cops Under Fire on Greg Kelly tonight. Newsmax is on all major cable systems. If you don't get it, call your cable company. Get Newsmax TV free on most smart TVs, Roku, Pluto, Zumo, and YouTube Live. Millions have already downloaded the free Newsmax TV app on their smartphones. Already the fourth highest rated cable news channel in America. Newsmax is real news for real people.
Russia's defense ministry is ordering its troops to begin withdrawing from the Ukrainian border in a move that could help defuse tension with Kiev and the West. The order comes a day after Russian President Vladimir Putin warned adversaries that Moscow would deliver a swift and harsh response to any foreign threat amid a vast buildup of forces near its border with eastern Ukraine. NBA star LeBron James is being criticized for a now-deleted tweet. James had posted the photo of the police officer involved in the shooting of a 16-year-old knife-wielding black girl in Ohio with the caption, "You're next." The tweet got backlash from the National Fraternal Order of Police and Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas.
This is a pattern where the left consistently goes after, attacks, and demonizes police officers, and they do so often before the facts are known. Their immediate reaction whenever there's an incident is the police officers in the wrong.
USA Radio News.
Hi, this is Wyatt Cox. Each and every day, the USA Radio Network produces 3 hours of the greatest radio programs of all time. Comedies, drama, suspense, it's all there. Classic radio theater. Now, if your radio station doesn't carry the program, you can find them anywhere podcasts are served, including iHeartRadio, Spotify, Spreaker. Just search for USA Classic Radio Theater. Find it. USA Classic Radio Theater. You'll love it.
Another governor is calling on the Biden administration to address